This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you today. And I must say, I am very excited about today's program because I've often said, at least my opinion is that many of the things that we call, quote, paranormal or supernatural may have a scientific explanation. And that's why I'm so excited when I see somebody actually academically working out in the field to try to correlate some of these things that we think about in a spiritual sense and so forth. And we have a guest like that today, and I'm excited to have him on the program. He is Dr. Jim B. Tucker. He is the Bonner Lowry Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia. He's continuing the work of Dr. Ian Stevenson at the UVA Division of Perceptual Studies with children who report memories of previous lives. A board-certified child psychiatrist, Dr. Tucker worked with Dr. Stevenson for several years before taking over the research upon Dr. Stevenson's retirement in 2002. Dr. Tucker was born and raised in North Carolina. He attended the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he graduated Phi Beta Kappa with a BA degree in psychology in 1982, followed by a medical degree 4 years later. He then received training in general psychiatry and child psychiatry at the University of Virginia. After completing his training, he stayed in Charlottesville and began a successful private practice in psychiatry. Now, we're going to let him explain how he got into this area, which I think is interesting in and of itself. But he ended up giving up his private practice, working at UVA on this subject, and he has now published 2 books and numerous papers on the subject in scientific journals. He has spoken before both scientific and general audiences and has made a number of television appearances, including Good Morning America, Larry King Live, and CBS Sunday Morning. Dr. Jim B. Tucker, welcome to the program today.
Thanks very much for having me.
So I guess the first question would be, how do you go from being so academically centered to a subject which, quite frankly, some people might consider, for lack of a better phrase, woo-woo? How did you get into this?
Well, a bit of a long story. I certainly would not have predicted it. You mentioned I was raised in North Carolina. I was raised Southern Baptist, where we certainly did not talk about past lives. And I was in private practice, just having a mainstream career of child psychiatry. When my wife and I got together, she was open to things like reincarnation and psychic abilities and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Now she's a clinical psychologist, which got me curious enough to read up on things. And I read one of Ian Stevenson's books, and I was quite taken, not just with the idea of looking at the question of life after death, but the careful scientific approach he had to looking at that question. It's very sober, grounded kind of work, even though it's a topic that a lot of people tend to stay away from. So I eventually called the office to see if they needed volunteer help, initially for a near-death experience study. And that sort of got my foot in the door, and kind of one thing led to another, and now here I am.
What were some of the initial experiences that you heard out in the field that kind of got you hooked on this? What made you, some of the results and the findings that you were getting back, some of the stories that you were getting back and the observations, what were some of the ones that said, wait a minute, I didn't think there was anything to this, but maybe I need to take another look?
Well, there are a lot of cases. Ian and colleagues have studied 2,500 cases before I even got involved. So there are a lot of good ones, and one, there's this little girl in Sri Lanka who talked about being an incense maker and even gave the names of 2 brands that she said she had made, and said she had been killed when she was selling incense and got hit by a truck, and she eventually pointed out a temple on TV and said that she had lived on the other side of the river from that temple. When people went to look on the other side of that temple, it's 150 miles away, they found a family of incense makers, and they were making the 2 brands that she had named, even though they weren't even available in her local area. Mm-hmm. And they had lost a family member when he had been hit by a bus. So you hear cases like that, and it becomes pretty hard to dismiss them. That was a case studied by a colleague of ours, Erlinger Harrelson, but there are tons of cases like this, mostly in Asia, that Ian focused on, because it's easiest to find cases in cultures with a belief in reincarnation. I eventually turned my attention to American cases, even though they're harder to find here. Now with the internet, families find us, and there are also some really compelling cases that happen right here in families who had never considered reincarnation before, and of course in a culture that doesn't have a belief in reincarnation.
Why is it that you think that cases in Eastern cultures, Asia and so forth, are easier to find than here? Is it just that? Is that it's not considered kosher here?
Well, that's certainly a big part of it. Now, they may be more common there, but certainly parents will listen more if a child starts talking about past life memories here. You know, parents, until the child says enough, parents tend to just ignore it or kind of dismiss it as make-believe. And also, once a child does start talking about these things, in a lot of the places in Asia where we visited, people then talk about them. The families will tell their neighbors, and sort of word gets out, and then we eventually would have associates there who would hear about them. Whereas here, of course, a lot of families are quite embarrassed by what their children are saying, and they don't tell anyone. I mean, I've talked with parents where they haven't even told the grandparents, because they just think that people think it's weird or un-Christian or whatever. They tend to keep it to themselves.
One of the critiques that I've heard of reincarnation is this idea that everybody comes back and says that they were a prince or they were royalty or somebody very important. Now, does that map to what you actually are hearing out in the field? Are there a lot of people out there reporting that they were ditch diggers in the past life?
Absolutely. They describe very ordinary lives. And in my new book, Return to Life, I do have a couple of cases where the children talk about being people who were well-known, at least in their lifetimes. But the vast majority are describing people who lived rather nondescript lives. The one part of the past life that tends to be exceptional is how the previous person died. 70% of them, the previous person died by unnatural means, meaning murder, suicide, accident, war, that sort of thing. And that certainly seems to be a factor in our cases. They also tend to die quite young. Even the natural death cases tends to be an early death. So there is this sort of premature death issue that seems significant in the past lives. But otherwise, there's nothing, usually nothing spectacular about the life at all.
Taking a look at this from a scientific perspective, it's not necessarily something that you can put in a test tube or put on a scale, so I'm sure that the anecdotal nature of a lot of this has its own challenges. And if I were a skeptic, one of the first things I would say, well, how in the world do you control for exaggeration, for outright fabrication, for maybe trumping up things a little more exciting than they are? How do you control for all that from a scientific standpoint?
Well, that's certainly an issue. And yes, when you're studying spontaneous, unpredictable events like past life memories, it's not a controlled test tube lab research. But there are things that we look for to bolster the case. And in a number of cases, there are written records that were made of the child's statements before the previous person was identified. Mm-hmm. And in that case, we know there's no exaggeration or trumping up because we've got the records right in front of us. And then in cases without those, we'll try to interview as many witnesses as possible and try to determine as carefully as we can exactly what the child said about the past life. And then go to the other side of the case, try to determine just how accurate it is for the person who lived before.
One thing that fascinates me is this idea of child prodigies. Somebody who, you know, at the age of 4 can play a piano concerto or something like that. Now, I'm not thinking of a specific person. I know in your most recent book, Return to Life, Extraordinary Cases of Children Who Remember Past Lives, I believe you have in there a story about a young golfing prodigy. And I think that's a fascinating case study.
Well, that's right. And I should preface this by saying child prodigies are certainly a fascinating phenomenon, but I'm not aware of any other than this golfing child, of any for the children have reported memories of past lives. So okay. It's certainly speculative you have to wonder, where did that come from? Did it come from past life? But
you're not making that claim.
Memories, it's hard to know. But yeah, this was a little kid who, from the time he was two, he showed both a tremendous fascination with golf and also a tremendous ability. Initially his parents had gotten him a little set of plastic golf clubs, and he was so obsessed with those, they eventually got him a set of child's clubs. And he showed such a natural swing that the local golf clubs, which would normally give lessons to kids who are 5 years old or older, agreed to take him on when he was two. And one day, his parents did not play golf. And one day his dad was going through the channels on television and didn't know that they even got the golf channel, but there it was. And the boy became enraptured by it, and they would really have to, he didn't want to watch any other TV. He just wanted to watch the golf channel, and they'd have to limit his time. But one time there was a thing on Bobby Jones, who was a very famous golfer back in the 20s. And this kid said that he was Bobby Jones. And, you know, with a kind of extravagant claim like that, we always tend to be a little skeptical. But he did pick out Bobby Jones's childhood home and also pick out a friend of his. So there was some evidence to back that up. But the biggest evidence was that this kid's golfing talent. And he's now seven the last time I had contact with his parents. And he's still loves golf and is still very good at it. In fact, at one point he won 21 tournaments in a row. So he does seem to be, at the very least, very gifted. And his talent matches this these memories that he appeared to have at a very early age.
Now, that's a question. I've heard that these things fade. You know, a child will report these things early on, 2-3 years old, whatever it is. And then over time, these past life memories will fade. Does that map to what you found out in the field?
Yes, it does. The kids almost always stop talking about these things by the time they're 6 or 7. And we have thought they forgot, although a colleague of ours recently interviewed adults who had been studied when they were kids, and a surprising minority said that they still had some memories. But they certainly stopped talking about it, and I think most of them do lose the memories. And it's around the same time that we all lose our memories of early childhood. I mean, most of us remember essentially nothing before the age of 4 or 5, 5 or 6. And this seems to go along with that. And it kind of makes sense that if you're going to lose memories of early childhood, it makes sense you'd also lose memories from a past life. But yeah, that's certainly the case. So there's a narrow window in which to hear what these kids have to say about this, and then they just sort of go on with their lives like everybody else.
Well, we're going to hear more about these children and their extraordinary memories. Right after this, we'll be back with Dr. Jim B. Tucker on reincarnation and the scientific proof. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody. I wanted to tell you about a couple of cool things. First of all, I want to tell you where I'm going to be May 16th through the 18th. And if you're in the general region, it might be an opportunity for us to meet. I'm going to be at the Big Cleveland Pop Expo that's coming up. And that is going to be May 16th through the 18th at the Cleveland Convention Center. It's a new multi-million dollar gleaming convention center. We're pretty proud of it in these parts. And what a great event. Now, the Pop Expo really has something for anybody who is into collectibles, trivia, fantasy, cosplay, horror, gaming, sci-fi. And I'm just really excited to be a part of it. And when you look at it, the kind of people that are going to be there, some of the people you're going to get to meet, Kelly LeBrock and Anthony Michael Hall from Weird Science, and then people like Ernie Hudson from Ghostbusters, James Marsters from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Linda Blair from The Exorcist, that's one I'm really looking forward to, Todd Bridges from Different Strokes, a cast reunion from the 1980s Savage Streets program, and much more. And there'll be an opportunity for attendees, for you, to participate in things like the cosplay tournament, the trivia championship, card trading games and tournaments, and a movie riff-off challenge. So how do you get connected into all of this? Go to popexpos.com. That's P-O-P-E-X-P-O-S.com. Children 12 and under receive free admission. And they're going to have that big reunion for the movie Weird Science. If you remember that movie from the 80s, that's when I was a teenage boy. So going to get to meet Kelly LeBrock. Wow. That's pretty cool. It's going to be Friday, Saturday, Sunday, May 16th, 17th, and 18th. And really looking forward to it. I hope I meet you there. It's a great deal, and I think that you'll enjoy it. So if you're in the region, the Midwest of the United States, you might want to pop on over to Cleveland. We have a lot going on these days. Of course, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and all of the different events. But this is the main attraction that weekend, May 16th through the 18th. Check it out, the Cleveland Pop Expo at the Cleveland Convention Center. See you there. And the other cool thing I want to tell you about is my Paranormal Plus Club. You know, over 780 podcasts. And this week, we talked to Echo Bodine. She's a psychic, and she says through communications she's received that she knows what happens when we die. And that's kind of the lead show this week. That's on our Other Side series, and that's only available via my Plus Club over at jimherold.net. Later in the week, we'll be talking to Paul Burley about Stonehenge and the secrets that lie in Stonehenge, what that's all about. Looking forward to that towards the end of the week. And on April 21st, we have one of our interactive webinars, which are really cool. And I think that people forget about this part of the Plus Club. As part of a Plus Club membership, you get access to a treasure trove of video presentations that we've done with different speakers on different paranormal topics. We've done things like the tarot and how to ghost hunt and black-eyed kids and UFOs and Michelle Belanger with lucid dreaming and the paranormal, things like that. And there are a bunch of archived things that you can watch with presentations just like you'd see at conferences. And we have another one coming up this month. This is with Thomas Fusco. He's been very popular on our shows. And he has a scientific theory to explain the paranormal. And he's going to be joining us once this month and once next to talk about it. And the title of his talk is Paranormal Mechanics, the Information Paradigm, and the Big Bang. So I'm really looking forward to that. That'll be on the evening of April 21st. And if for some reason you sign up and you can't make that date, rest assured it is going to be archived at jimherold.net for as long as the site is up. So so no need to worry. So you can plug into 780 podcasts, including all those archived campfire shows that maybe you've never had a chance to listen to that are no longer on the free feed. Same with the Paranormal Podcast, those shows going all the way back to 2005. And then over a couple of hundred shows that have never been on the free feed, all of my Plus Club shows, like the one with Echo Bodine that I just told you about, all those you've not gotten to listen to, plus all these webinars. Plus, I have meet and greets. We just had one last night where I talk with listeners and answer their questions and so forth. Plus, we have a new site redesign over there at jimherold.net. If you haven't checked it out, things are much easier to find, much cleaner, and you get a sense for just all of the great content. If you go over there, I would tell you to first thing to look at in the menu, there's a button that says listing of all Plus content. Click on that. Just click on that and you will see what you're missing. It's literally a page of hundreds of titles of programs, and you can access it for free, that listing it is. So go over to listing of all Plus Club, Plus content over at jimherold.net, and you'll really get an appreciation for what you're missing by not being a member. And even if you have no intention of joining, I would just ask you to do that one thing. Go over to jimherold.net and click on listing of all Plus content. It is on the menu. There's two menu bars. It's on the lower menu bar, and you'll see it there. Right in about the middle of the page, listing of all Plus content. You're not a member, have no intention, just do me a favor anyway, as a thank you for the free shows we provide. Go over to jimherold.net and click on that listing of all Plus content. That will give you an idea of what you're missing by not being a member. I thank you so much for listening. I hope that you will check out the popexpos.com that I told you about, the Cleveland Pop Expo, and also my site, over at jimherold.net.
Would you love to get paranormal news, show updates, and more delivered to your email inbox every week? Go to jimherold.com today. Sign up for Jim's free paranormal e-newsletter. Plus, you'll be entered into a random drawing to win free paranormal books. One lucky reader wins every month. Sign up for the newsletter today at jimherold.com. Now, we return to the Paranormal Podcast.
We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Dr. Jim B. Tucker. We are talking about the scientific proof for reincarnation. His most recent book is Return to Life, Extraordinary Cases of Children Who Remember Past Lives. Now, Dr. Tucker, I'm one of those people who waffles back and forth on reincarnation. On one hand, it's against everything I was taught religiously, a very similar kind of background. But on the other hand, you got to think there's something to these stories, but then my skeptical side comes in as well, and I think about things like false memories and things that kids see on TV, and maybe they pick it up and internalize it and spit it back out, kind of like that Bobby Jones story. How do you guard against that and control for that kind of thing?
Well, I think in the strongest cases, the kids have given details that they couldn't possibly have sword from TV or anywhere else. I mean, they're describing an obscure figure from some time ago in a distant location, and there's just no way they would have known about it. Now, you know, if kids give details about various subjects or various times, or those things they may have heard on TV, but when they're talking about a specific individual who it turns out did live and die and matches the details the child gave, I don't think we can just decide, well, that must have been something he heard on television. As far as the sort of the general question of reincarnation, it is one that's foreign to a lot of us because we don't grow up hearing it. And I've never claimed that these cases provide evidence that we all reincarnate. They are evidence that there may be a part of us that survives after death, but whether the typical pattern is to come back into another life in this world or not, these cases don't really address.
One thing that I found interesting was I watched a YouTube video that you had been on, and you told this fascinating case study about a child named Sam, and the story of where he said he was his grandfather, and I thought there were some incredible revelations in that. Can you recount a little bit of that one for us?
Yeah, sure. He was a little boy who his paternal grandfather, his father's father, died a year and a half before Sam was born. And then when Sam was a year and a half old, his dad was changing his diaper one day, and Sam looked up at him and said, "When I was your age, I used to change your diaper."
That would be shocking.
It certainly was to his parents. His mom told me how she remembered the puzzled face on Sam's dad. I mean, a puzzled expression on the face of Sam's dad when he came out after changing him. And his parents had never considered reincarnation. In fact, his mom was the daughter of a Baptist missionary. But he started talking about these things, saying how I was Grandpa Gus and I used to be big, and his mom in particular became curious about this, so she would ask him questions. So when she asked him, for instance, if he had any siblings, he said how he had had a sister and that she had died. Bad men had turned her into a fish. Well, it turned out that Sam's grandfather, some 60 years before, had a sister who was murdered, and her body was then dumped in the bay. And Sam's parents felt certain that he'd never heard anyone talk about that. He also talked about how at the end of his life, his wife would make milkshakes for him every day, and not just that she would make milkshakes, but that she'd make them in the food processor rather than in the blender. And in fact, that was true for Sam's grandparents. And then eventually when he was four, his grandmother, who had had a series of strokes, Sam never saw her make milkshakes for anyone, but she'd had a series of strokes. She died when he was four. Dad came back with a bunch of family photos, and Sam's mom had him out one day looking at him on the coffee table, and Sam walks over and starts pointing to pictures of his grandfather and saying, "That's me, that's me." So to test him, she showed him a picture from a elementary class picture of about 25 kids and said, "All right, show us who you are." And he was able to pick him out of the picture. And this is at age 4. So that's certainly one. I mean, it has the inherent weakness that it's what we call a same family case. So you have to wonder about, could he have learned things about his grandfather through normal means? But certainly his parents felt he had not. But then we've also got American cases where the child is describing a complete stranger from decades before, and you know, there's no way that the child had overheard this.
One thing that I find interesting is this idea of birthmarks and the part that they play or the role that they play. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that was an area that Ian Stevenson, my mentor, was extremely interested in. He was always interested in psychosomatic medicine, but connection between mind and body. And these are cases, he collected several hundred of them, of children who are born with birthmarks or birth defects, including some quite dramatic defects, that match wounds, usually fatal wounds, on the body of the previous person. And so along with the stigmas, there's this physical evidence, and in fact, he documented that there were 18 cases where the children were born with double birthmarks. It's where the previous person had been shot and killed, and the child was born with birthmarks that matched both the entrance wound and the exit wound from the gunshot. And then ones were malformed fingers and missing limbs and all kinds of things that correlate with the injuries of the previous person.
You talked about golfing before and the young man who had the fascination with golfing. Do you see that often, that there might be a particular obsession with a subject that seems to come out of nowhere, doesn't necessarily map to the parents' interests? And do you see kind of any correlation with any past life stories in that regard?
Yes, we certainly do. And both fascination with things, and often in the children's play, there'll be a connection with these memories they're describing, often the occupation of the previous person. So there's one case, an American case, James Leininger, which has gotten a fair amount of attention, and his parents eventually wrote a book about their experiences. But from the time he was 2, he showed a real fascination with airplanes. But he also had these horrific nightmares 4 or 5 times a week where he's would be kicking his legs up in the air, screaming, "Airplane crash on fire, little man can't get out." And then during the day, he would take his little toy airplanes and say, "Airplane crash on fire," and just slam them into the coffee table over and over again, to the point, I saw a picture of the coffee table, and there are dozens of dents and scratches. I guess his parents are pretty tolerant people. But dozens of dents and scratches where he was just compulsively, it almost sounds like PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. This kid is compulsively acting this stuff out. And then, again, still when he was age 2, started talking about how he had had a plane that had crashed on fire, how he had been shot down by the Japanese, and how he flew a Corsair, which is a type of plane I'd never heard of, but it's a type of plane that was used in World War II. And then he said how he had flown off of a boat and said the name of the boat was Natoma, which is sort of a strange name. It's not one I would have guessed. He also said that there was a friend on the boat named Jack Larson. Well, it turned out that there was this ship, USS Natoma Bay, that was in World War II in the Pacific. And James said how he'd been shot down by the Japanese at Iwo Jima, and there was one pilot from this boat that was killed at Iwo Jima. His plane got shot exactly as James described it. He said it got hit in the engine, it burst into flames, crashed in the water, and quickly sank. And that's exactly what happened to the one pilot who was killed from the Natoma Bay there. And on the day he was killed, the pilot of the plane next to his was named Jack Larson, the name that James Leininger had given. So that was one where the behavior is like you asked about, and then there are also these statements, and it's from someone who had been killed 60 years before, James is from Louisiana. The pilot was from Pennsylvania. I mean, it seemed absolutely impossible that he could have learned these things in any sort of normal way. And along with the apparent memories were these quite pronounced behaviors where it all really fit.
Now, something I want to ask you about, and I don't know if it's something that you get into, but I'm sure you have an opinion on it, is sometimes adult people think that they've had a past life and they want to research it, so they engage in past life regression. A, is that something that you've worked with at all? And B, do you have a particular opinion on it?
I have not worked with it, and in fact, we're quite skeptical of it. And Ian Stevenson, who did do some work with it, was quite skeptical also, because hypnosis itself is a very unreliable tool, even for memories of this life. I mean, sometimes you can get amazing hits like license plate numbers at crime scenes or whatever. But a lot of times the mind just fills in the blanks with fantasy. And then it's very hard for the person to tell if it's an actual memory or not. When you look at past life hypnotic regression, with occasional exception, there's not much reason to think that people are recalling actual memories of past lives. Now, there are a few impressive cases, but the vast majority is probably fantasy. Now, it may well be therapeutic, and people like Brian Weiss, who's a psychiatrist in Florida, have used it for therapeutic purposes, but that doesn't mean that it's an actual memory of a past life that the person is having.
So at this point, how do you see taking the research forward? Certainly, you can continue to collect cases, and that has value. But is there any way to move the ball forward, as it were, to further trying to verify this particular thesis?
Well, I do want to continue to collect especially strong American cases because, we've got over 2,500 cases from various parts of the world. But I think the American ones are harder to dismiss because they don't have the potential cultural influences that the Asian ones do. Beyond that, with each case, we code them on 200 variables and put them into a database, and it's taken us years to... We still don't have all the cases in the database, but we've got over 2,000 of them now. So we can certainly look at patterns in the cases that you can't see on an individual level. We want to do more and more of that analysis, which I think can be quite interesting. And I'm hoping that we can use these cases and use this phenomenon to explore a little bit the whole issue of mind and consciousness and physical reality and the potential interactions between them. I don't know exactly where I will go with all that, but it's certainly an area that is of great interest to me.
So it would seem to, I think the scientific view is, at least at this point in general, is that you're born. Your brain creates what many call the soul. I think the average scientist would say, that's a lot of spiritual hokum. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but I would think that would be the case. And when you're dead, you're dead. Your research would beg to differ, it would seem.
Well, that's right. And I don't think you can map these cases onto a materialistic kind of view of reality, that matter is all there is. But there are other reasons to think that worldview is incorrect, scientific materialism. Certainly there are other areas of research, like with near-death experiences, some of the work with mediumship and various things like that, that provide evidence that consciousness can continue. And then there's the troubling field of quantum physics, which... none of us claims to have a great explanation, but it's clear that the physical world, at least at the smallest level, does not operate in a way that we think it does, and it does not operate in a way that our day-to-day experiences tell us it does. And a big piece of that seems to, at the very least, it's observation, and seems to be consciousness. I would argue that consciousness should be considered an entity separate from the physical world, and therefore not contingent on the physical brain for existence, but the brain would be more of where it transmits consciousness from somewhere else, but not necessarily that it creates consciousness in and of itself.
Now, you had mentioned earlier that you grew up, I believe, Southern Baptist.
Yes.
I'm assuming that, aside from the scientific, this has had to have you reevaluate your own thought processes on spirituality and the nature of existence and so forth. I would think that would be a natural result.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, I have to say I was not a practicing anything by the time I started this research. But I've always had respect for spirituality and interest in spirituality. This has certainly given me a much broader view of it than sort of the strictly religious context of the church that, you know, I attended when I was a child. I think this kind of work certainly indicates that the world is more wondrous than just the materialistic viewpoint. And it also suggests, I mean, if you accept these cases, it suggests that we don't necessarily know everything about the spiritual world either. And of course, most of us wouldn't claim to know everything. Most of our parents of our American cases have not believed in reincarnation before the children started talking, and many of them have been Christians. And they've been able to incorporate their experiences into their worldview. And I think a lot of people can, even though it's obviously reincarnation is not a central tenet of Christianity. But polling has showed that 20% of American Christians actually believe in reincarnation, so it's a substantial minority. And they have these beliefs along with the more traditional Christian beliefs of God and Jesus and those things. I don't see that they are automatically in conflict with each other, but these, you know, these cases obviously do provide a lot of food thought for all of it.
If a parent starts noticing some strange statements, out of place statements, and they suspect maybe something along these lines are going on, what would be your recommendations?
Well, I think, as with anything that children say, the parents need to be open to what their children are saying. Not necessarily diving in with a bunch of pointed questions, which may either scare the children or may lead them to make things up, but just to be open and to ask to hear more. When they're hearing these statements and seeing these behaviors, I think they can be reassured that they do not indicate any sort of mental illness. I mean, we've done psychological testing with a number of them, and other than being, they tend to be quite intelligent, but otherwise they're certainly normal kids. I would encourage parents to write down what the children are saying. So if eventually they say enough where the memories can be verified, it's great to have a written record. And then they are certainly free to contact me. The simplest way is through my website, www.jimbtucker.com, and there's contact links there. And they can link to the university site from there that has a lot of our papers, and they can learn more about the topic. But in general, they shouldn't be upset by what the children are saying. They should be supportive, but also to focus on this life. And if the children seem too disturbed by the memories, just to let them know that they're safe in this life with them and that they're going to have a happy life in the family they're in now.
And to close out, your latest book is Return to Life, Extraordinary Cases of Children Who Remember Past Lives. If you could tell us a little bit, if we pick up that book, what to expect and also where we can find it.
Well, it's stories of my recent investigations, mostly American cases, and including James Leininger, who I talked about earlier. The story both of the family's experiences and then my study of the cases. And then at the end of the book, I try to make sense of them all, sort of like we were talking about earlier. And I do bring in some quantum physics, and you know, it's challenging material. But then I kind of present my thoughts on what this may all mean. As far as where to find it, certainly on all the online booksellers like Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and hopefully the local bookstores as well.
Dr. Jim B. Tucker, thank you for an interesting program. Very compelling stuff, and salute to your work for taking a scientific look at what we've long thought to be the supernatural. Thank you again for joining us today.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
And thank you for joining us on the Paranormal Podcast, and we'll talk to you next time. Have a great week, everybody. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.